What's up, Ethan? How was your week?
It's going well, man. It's good to see you. How you been?
I'm great. I feel so good to be in the sunshine right now. I'm in Miami. Oh, yeah. So for anybody listening and anybody watching, thank you ahead of time for putting up with the maybe less than ideal sound quality. I don't have my super, you know, spaceship studio behind me. My wife and I, we got the hell out of Dodge. We're spending a month in Miami Beach. I'm sure you can relate to this. We spent the last 2 years not doing anything except for working, right? And like, I didn't spend any money. I didn't go anywhere. So it's just like, you know, we saved all of our money. We worked super, super hard. We have this human. I was like, let's just drive to Miami and hang out there for a month. So here I am. And thanks to everybody for putting up with the regular microphone in my Surface for the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, the man's living the dream. Got to give him a break on that. I think this is going to be the year for travel. Everyone thought it was going to be last summer, but it really, and maybe this is just me being optimistic and I'll be saying the same thing next year. I hope not. But it really does feel, doesn't it? It feels like, like this is going to be the year. Like everything is kind of opening back up. And like you said, people have been socking cash away for a little while. Like, I think this is going to be the summer to travel. I've been speaking with a handful of people, especially international travel too. Like everyone's just ready to get back to it. So we'll see what happens.
Well, yeah. And I mean, just think about it, right? I have 3 employees in Brazil, contractors in London, the Philippines, all over the country. And all of it is done through Slack, a lot of Loom videos. It used to be Zoom, but I don't know if you guys have Slack Pro with your organization. They just created those huddles, you know, where you can all just basically jump on the phone together through the Slack channels. And it was a big adjustment for sure, just to figure out how to communicate when you can't like walk into the room and talk to each other. But it's so efficient. And as long as you create like the real, like the processes to make sure everybody understands how to effectively communicate digitally, it's ridiculously efficient, and I'm enjoying it very much. So I agree. We all have this newfound freedom, especially us as writers, to go where we want and do what we want as long as we get our work done. So I'm really optimistic about the next year for sure.
That's a cool way of putting it. I hadn't thought of this, but because I've been remote for 10 years now, and you know, when everybody else was kind of forced into it, that was like the first major learning. But I hadn't really realized until you just said that like nobody's really been able to experience the benefit of remote work. Like for everybody who was able to go remote, you had that one major benefit of being able to keep your job at a time when that was really important. Mm-hmm. So that was good. But most of the world still hasn't experienced that upside of like, you can travel, you can work in different time zones, and it'll be interesting to see, because right now there's still this big debate over whether or not remote is going to be the future. But we have only really seen one side of the equation, where like these mega companies have their employees sitting at home. So we'll see what happens when people are able to actually get out and like really travel and kind of leverage this.
Yeah.
You mentioned too writing. I think this is probably a good like entryway into what we're talking about today. But just as a quick point, have you ever thought about how writers really were the first remote workers? There's this line, I can't remember if it's in the Green Hills of Africa or if it's in A Movable Feast, but it's a Hemingway line where he talks about thinking about traveling and he wants to get out of town. And he talks about the writing and how he was working as a journalist for the Toronto Star at the time. And he says, you know, I could do that anywhere as long as I had like a pile of paper and a few sharp pencils, something to that effect.
I love that.
Yeah. And for a long time he did. Like he would hand in assignments for these major publications from all over the world. And it just struck me when I really first got into his stuff that like writers have always kind of been the first remote workers. So
yeah, especially Hemingway too. I think he ended up in Key West. Yeah. I'm almost positive it was Hemingway. You're shaking your head, so I think you got this right. But yeah, I've been to his little like liquor pad cottage in Key West. Just like got shit faced and wrote books for a couple of years.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, especially, I actually look to him as an example. I would love, not for everything, obviously, but for work life balance, Hemingway was incredible because, and part of this, it should be said, was because his wives very often supported him financially, mm-hmm. like right out of the gate. But he would like fish for 4 months of the year, and he'd like convince, what is it, Esquire or Men's Health or something like that to pay for it. And yeah, you know, I don't know how much that used to cost, but he'd go down to Cuba, rent like one room in a hotel by the water. And then they would ice down a fishing boat every day and just spend the entire day for months at a time fishing. And I was just, and you know, he writes so beautifully about it and like how they would take these lunches on the beach and barbecue whatever they had caught, and you know, how they could buy avocados, like 10 avocados for a nickel or something. And it just makes you think like, man, when's that's something that's so rare to experience these days. Sure. Like who listening to this is ever going to experience 4 months a year just for fishing? Then there's the trip to Africa. Then there's, you know, the trip to the Iowa to hunt or whatever. I think he's a really interesting case study in like having your priorities and also learning how to push for that time.
Yeah.
And I still think, I don't know, do you think it's possible to do that still? Do you know anybody who's doing something like that now, right? Where they're maybe writing or running some kind of like info business and they take the majority of the year to travel or like,
I don't think the majority of the year. I can think of friends of mine, like one of my best friends, Butcher, Josh Butcher. If you ever read my blog, I mentioned him in some of the stories. He's been my best friend for a while. He is an avid overlander, is the new thing, where they basically pack up their Jeeps and they just drive everywhere. Like that's what they do, basically. They just drive mostly out west in like Colorado and Utah and California and New Mexico. And I'd say he's on the road for 3 months of the year. So for sure, it is certainly possible to do it. And through my encouragement, he even created a YouTube channel and a blog called Overlanding Now, where he documents his journey and he sells affiliate products, because you know, you sell one tent that you strap on the top of your Jeep and the thing's like $3,000, you know, and he makes $300 for doing a product review on his phone in the middle of Utah about like how cool his tent is that he hooked up to the top of his Wrangler. So yeah, it's more and more possible to live like this every day, especially for people that write, just because there's never not a need for it. So yeah, interesting. Yeah, very, very interesting, man. I'm encouraged and just optimistic about the future.
Right on. So by the way, I'll just very briefly dovetail us into what we came here to talk about today. So
what are we doing today?
I'll tell people how we're going to get there. So like this lifestyle is possible. It's even more possible if you use that framework that we laid out in the last two episodes ago.
Mm-hmm.
That framework, for everybody who maybe didn't hear it, is like you start with cash flow, then you have to build trust and influence, and then you build products. And one of the things that we wanted to talk about today is how do you basically grow that trust and influence, like your newsletter? How do you grow that list? And how do you do it without money? So I literally woke up this morning and Tim had texted me. He said, this is the topic for today's chat. And he sent a tweet that was from a good friend of mine, Alex Garcia. Alex used to run social media here at The Hustle. And now I think he's over at Gumroad. And he's also doing his own thing. He's got this really cool paid newsletter on growth marketing called Growth Marketing Examined, or can't remember if it's Marketing Examined or Growth Marketing Examined, but he's doing some really cool stuff and he really knows how to grow audiences. So I'm going to read the tweet real fast and then I want to hear why you thought this is what we should talk about. Okay. Nice. So here's the tweet. It's pretty cool. How to build an email list without paid marketing. It's 5 steps. First, list customer pain points, then list frequently asked questions, and create SEO optimized blogs answering these questions. Then create free courses around those subjects, and finally link to the free courses from the blog post. And the idea is that those free courses are going to drive email signups. I like this post when I first saw it, and I really like the way he's kind of laid out the case study in a super like visual manner, which is easy to digest. So talk to me, man. What caught your eye here? Why is this the topic for today? And then we'll launch into some more of the nitty gritty.
Okay, it's the topic that I like for two reasons. One, because it said without paid marketing. Now, don't get me wrong. I am a huge proponent for spending money. I didn't have any money for like most of my life, right? And I have also found that it's very intimidating for people who want to grow an audience to just jump right into like Facebook or Google and start throwing money into the void of the internet without necessarily knowing what's happening. It's very rare that people like have just not even necessarily the fortitude. It's just not the place to start, right? If you're just getting started, who wants to burn cash on Facebook and Instagram ads? So most of the people listening to this or watching this video are going to want to learn how to build an audience without paid marketing, at least until you get to, you know, 1,000, 5,000, 10,000 signups, like we talk about. So that's a really distinction. But the part that caught my eye is the first bullet point here. List customer pain points, because this is something at Copyblogger that we talk about a lot. And Brian Clark and myself, I learned this from Brian years ago, really, but this one lesson had such a huge impact on me. And I think it has a lot to do with why I've been so effective with content marketing. Because when you list customer pain points, basically what you're doing is you're finding your perfect customer. And what does like the typical marketing guru say in this position? They say like, okay, you have to find the demographic, right? Who is this person? How old is he? How old is she? Where do they live? Blah, 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 blah. And Brian told me from the very beginning, demographics are a terrible way to build an audience. What you want to do is invest in psychographic. And psychographic is pretty simple. Like, what are their interests? What are their biases? And what are their hobbies? So a really great example for this is, okay, a demographic could be, we want somebody who lives in England, who is considered royalty, and is 70 years old and lives in a castle, right? Those are all demographics. But that could be either the Prince of England or it could be Ozzy Osbourne. And so like the demographics don't actually give you the perfect customer pain point that you're trying to solve for, but the psychographics do, because then all of a sudden, if you say, okay, we want somebody who's into, you know, like power chord guitar solos and old school heavy metal and like a legendary front man, right? Well, Ozzy Osbourne would fall into that psychographic, but so would a ton of other people who belong in many quote unquote demographics. So I think this is so interesting because I loved how Alex list customer pain points. And the part that really, really caught my attention is that when we say customer pain points, we want to look at that from a psychographic perspective and not from a demographic perspective. And if you do that, you'll know exactly who you're speaking to and you'll know exactly like who it is that needs your product or your service.
Hey there, it's Tim. And I need to take a moment to tell you about this show's sponsor. It's a product called Hype Fury. When I was able to speak to Yannick, who is the CMO, one of the founding partners of Hype Fury, and he agreed to sponsor the show, I was so thrilled. And the reason is because I have personally used Hype Fury for the last 3 years, and it has allowed me to build my social media following and my personal brand to over 70,000 followers. I could not have done it without Hype Fury. And I really, really mean that. I use this product every day, and it's added so much to my business and to my life. So Hype Fury is a social media scheduling tool. It has three main features that I think separates it from every other tool. One, it allows you to quickly create content and schedule them. So it's a very nuanced feature, but it's so helpful. Basically, I sit down at my desk in the morning and I type out my tweet, I type out my LinkedIn post, and then all I do is I hit enter, and Hype Fury schedules it at the opportune time on Twitter and on LinkedIn. I don't have to think about it any more than that. All I have to do is sit down and create my tweets, create my posts, hit enter, and Hype Fury does all the work for me. Second, Hype Fury makes it so that you can easily create threads. And threads have been the biggest value add for me in growing my following. So threads really helped me grow my following on Twitter. And those threads format themselves into longer form LinkedIn posts on LinkedIn. It's actually kind of funny. I made a video about this not too long ago about how, yes, like you want to create threads on Twitter. You want to be a thread boy, because I'd say like 80% of my growth on both Twitter and LinkedIn have been from threads and long form posts. And I wouldn't have been able to format any of this without using Hype Fury. And then third, Hype Fury is really good for keeping you inspired. So what it does is it shows you some of your most popular tweets and your most popular posts. And it basically gives you information. It gives you inspiration as to what your audience is looking for and what they most actively engage in. So you're never sitting at the computer thinking, oh man, like, what am I going to say today? What kind of content am I going to create today? It's constantly feeding you new ideas, new inspiration, and it allows you to quickly create this content so that you can continuously get yourself out there, continuously build your brand, and most importantly, turn that social media following into newsletter subscribers. So through Hype Fury, I've been able to grow my personal email list, timstodds.com, to over 30,000 followers. That's turned into a business within itself. It's really helped me grow the Copyblogger newsletter. We're at 110,000 followers right now. A whole lot of that is also because of Hype Fury. So please, this is a product that I use every single day. I personally vouch for it. You can check it out at hypefury.com, hypefury.com. And if you have any problems with it, you can send me a DM on Twitter, and I'm sure I can convince you as to why it will add value to your life. So hypefury.com. Thank you so much to Hype Fury for sponsoring the show. And let's get back to the episode.
That's really interesting. So I've never heard that example before, but I like it a lot, of like the guy who's 70 living in a castle. Yeah. I thought you were taking us all the way down to one person, but you're right. No, two thanks. Totally different people. That's cool. I have a couple of questions about how you approach this as well. How do you get there? Just because this is something you keyed in on early, how do you find those pain points? And specifically, I'm talking for you, like in your business, how do you guys do this today?
Well, I guess it depends on which company, right? And I don't say that to be like egotistical. I say that because like everything that we do has a very, very specific person. So the generic answer is what the guy from Entrepreneur on Fire, that podcast, I can't remember his name. It's like one of the most successful podcasts. He says, create an avatar. Who's the person driving down the road, and what do they think of, and what are they listening to? And I think that's like a really great exercise to do, just to kind of start getting the voices, the juices flowing, right? But really what I do is I focus on like, what is the problem that this person has? Because the only reason anybody ever spends money on anything is to solve a problem. And that problem could be that like they're bored. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's life or death. It just means that they have a need, a problem, and they want to solve for it. And so as I go into psychographics and I start dissecting who is it that I'm speaking to, the most specific of all of like those psychographic qualities is, what is the problem that this person has? And then how can I solve that? And so what's important here is, a lot of content entrepreneurs and writers make the mistake of saying like, I have a product to offer and I need to find the person to sell it to, where it's actually exactly the opposite. Like, you want to find the person that you're speaking to and then dissect the product that they need out of that. And that's why the whole Copyblogger mantra of like audience first has been so effective, because I've never actually gone into a scenario thinking like, I have a great idea for a product and like, I have to find my psychographic audience. It's been the opposite of that. It's been, okay, there's an audience like I'm interested in. There's a niche or an idea or something that like I have a personal interest in. So let me start creating content. Let me start building awareness, you know, basically start creating a list. And then eventually, through the act of writing and the act of interacting and listening and learning, I can figure out like, what is it that these people actually need? And then the trick is to take your ego out of it and never say like, oh, I have the best idea. I know what these people need. Like, they know what they need and they don't care what you think about it. And so if you can take your ego out of it, you can find the actual product or service that fits them.
Yeah. And if you figure out how to take your ego out of it, let me know.
Like me too.
I like this a lot. And I'll tell you why too, because it's not just important in terms of like figuring out where that market is. But I think once you figure out the psychographic, the way people think, it solves a lot of other problems too. So, and like one of them would be how to sell to these people. One thing we talk about on our team quite often is like the major kind of advantage that comes from understanding the way people talk about a problem that they have. So, you know, I think this is probably true throughout media, but like user interviews or reader interviews are a big part of what we do throughout the course of the year. And we don't spend a lot of time actually recording those interviews for a reason. I think there's a kind of a common practice of doing a bunch of interviews and then trying to like find the commonalities between all these people and boil it down to like a really clean, crisp user persona. And I've done that and it can be helpful. But what else is the other thing that's helpful is just getting your team to like talk to people enough times that they're going to sort of like absorb into the marrow of their bones the things that these people are talking about. And what you're really trying to do is put either yourself or members of your team in a position where when you go to make something, you're not making it for some imaginary audience that you think is going to like it. You're making it for somebody that you can literally picture, somebody exactly. You know, a real person. And getting there is a lot easier if you kind of skip that imaginary profile and think a little bit more in terms of like, who do I actually know who needs this or who am I going to talk to? When you go have those conversations, a lot of times, we're also, this is related to what I mentioned a moment ago in terms of how people talk about their issues. When you go have those conversations, what ends up happening, if you have enough of them, is that the same phrases pop up over and over and over again. Totally. And usually I find you need like somewhere between 5 and 10 interviews for that to start happening. And that is magic, because if you know what that phrase is, then you can start to use it when you're talking about the problem, whether that's on your landing page or in your headlines or in your body copy. And when people see that, they instantly think, when you can talk to them in the words that they use inside their own head to describe the problem, they instantly think, this person gets me, this was made for me, and I need this now. And like the price sensitivity, it doesn't go away completely, but it definitely changes if you can show them that you really understand them. So I love this concept of starting with psychographics. Hmm. We're going to go broader in a minute here, but are there any tools that you like to use when you're specifically kind of digging into this from a builder's perspective?
Yeah, SEMrush is the tool that I use the most, but also Google Trends is like super underrated. You can learn anything about people by figuring out what they're searching. And if you have like your finger on the pulse, you can just find opportunities everywhere. Like once you learn it, it's almost difficult to not get your brain spinning all the time, because like, oh my God, there's an opening here, there's an opening there, there's an opening there, right? But yeah, SEMrush is the specific tool that I probably use the most to find more long tail keywords. So this is getting a little bit deeper, but you know, for instance, if I was growing Stasi, the difference between if somebody searches for healthcare marketing and healthcare marketing agency, like those really, really small distinctions can lead to very different outcomes just because of the intention of the searcher. But in on a macro sense, if I were to look into Google Trends and just like follow what the search variations for something like healthcare marketing over the last 10 years would be, you can tell pretty quickly, like, okay, this is a place that I want to dig deeper into. So a bit of a long-winded answer, but yeah, SEMrush is my go-to, and Google Trends for sure. Google Trends is like, it's like a what is it? A genie's lamp, right? Like Aladdin, you know, like it can grant your wishes.
Yeah. I can't believe they give that away for free. Basically. Yeah. I got a couple more I'll throw in there too. So what are we really trying to give you for anybody who's like listening or watching? First, there's the framework that Alex laid out, right? You understand the pain points and questions of your audience. Then you create SEO optimized blog posts that answer those questions. Then you create courses around those subjects and link the two, right? So this is not like revolutionary. People, I think, know this. You're going to create some kind of downloadable product that people want. They're going to give you their information in exchange for the product. And how do you get them in the door? Well, you have to understand what they're trying to solve and provide that solution via SEO articles. Common approach. But I think it's helpful to talk through how people like Tim and myself have seen this implemented like out in the wild for anybody who's doing it for the first time. So you mentioned SEMrush as one potential tool, Google Trends, another one that's free. I wrote down a couple that I've been impressed with in recent years. So for me, I've never used SEMrush. I've heard great things. I am a big fan of Ahrefs. So yeah, for anybody who hasn't used this, Ahrefs, it's spelled Ahrefs. And it's a pretty powerful tool. I don't think I've used their entire suite of software, but one of the most powerful things that it can do is like a very detailed search engine optimization breakdown of different websites and different keywords. And I think whether it's Ahrefs or SEMrush or some other tool, there's a few, what the best ones are really going to offer you is basically like three things. They're going to show you something related to search volume, so popularity. They're going to show you how popular a particular search term is, so you can gauge the size of the audience. They'll show you how competitive it is, so you can kind of gauge the competitive landscape and whether or not you really have a chance to outrank people for that. And then they'll show you alternatives, so related terms that you maybe didn't think of that might be either easier to target or maybe even a little closer to the type of person that you're trying to get to. Like Tim mentioned, even a slight difference between healthcare marketing and healthcare marketing agency can lead to a big difference in business outcomes. Yeah. I always think of, I think it was Mark Twain who said something like the difference between the right word and the almost right word is like the difference between lightning and the lightning bug. And I always loved that quote. And that's what Tim is saying here. So let me just pause to double down on something that you said about search intent and like having the right word. This is something that often gets overlooked in people's SEO strategies. And it's something that a friend of mine, Steph Smith, has taught me a lot about. Steph's awesome. She's been on this show. She's been in the academy and she has an entire course on content marketing. And she's like the search engine whisperer as well. Her blog has gotten something like 300,000 views. And it got that much like in its first year. She's crazy good at SEO. And she talks a lot about this concept of search intent. It's important to understand. So the high level idea is like when somebody searches for a certain keyword, what outcome are they really looking for? Because it doesn't really matter if the keyword is related to you or your business, if the solution that you offer is not what they're actually looking for. Is there anything else you want to say about search intent?
No, you nailed it. I mean, almost a triple down on that. I cannot talk about how important it is. I cannot say enough how important it is, and also how easy it is to have this concept slip your mind when you're writing stuff. It's not the search query, it's the outcome. It's like the problem that they're trying to solve. So even like semantics and synonyms. And so here's a really great example. If somebody searches cars, right? Like, what the hell does that mean? Maybe they're looking for the movie about cars. Maybe they're looking for just old classic cars. Maybe they're looking to buy a car, right? Who knows? And so when you create your content strategy, you're not just, that's why in this thing, it says create SEO optimized blog posts answering these questions. That's like the real key phrase there in that bullet point, answering these questions. And so that's why in many cases, a great way to frame your keywords is to make the title of your article an actual question, because you kind of killed two birds with one stone there. Like you get the keyword and you nail down the search intent in one step. So yeah, I'm reiterating what you're saying, but I think that's a good helpful tip that has always helped me.
Yeah, that is really helpful. So if people keep that in mind, I think SEM Rush and Ahrefs are two good tools, but they're also expensive. And so I wanted at least Ahrefs. I don't know what SEM Rush goes for, but Ahrefs is like between $99. Okay, yeah. So these are tools that I mean, you could use as a freelancer, but you probably already have some level of traction by the time these really fit into the budget for the month. So I wanted to throw out a couple of alternatives as well, that these are things that I've used and really enjoyed. So one is a Chrome plugin called Keywords Everywhere. Have you ever seen this?
Mm-mm.
Okay, it's crazy. This is going to blow your mind. If you just Google search this, Keywords Everywhere, it comes right up. And it's basically a passive Chrome plugin that will display the search volume for any term that you plug into Google. So when you're just like kind of, I mean, if you can actively search for things, if I'm trying to figure out how to maybe like, I want to figure out how much search intent is around the notebook industry, right? Cause I want to build a list and audience around people who love notebooks. Well, I can install Keywords Everywhere and start searching on Google for different terms related to notebooks that I think people want. And it just displays the search volume. Typical cost per click. So if you're going to start doing paid ads, it'll show you what the typical CPC rates are to advertise in that space. And it'll show you how competitive the keyword is as well. Crazy, awesome tool. It'll also show you a whole bunch of alternatives. So it's a really great way to come up with, you know, alternative keywords. So that's a really cool tool. It's also very cheap. It's something like, you know, they charge based on the number of queries, but I think I spent $20 over the course of a year. And this thing is just always running in the background. It's really cool. So that's one. The other, this is a tip that I got from Sam one time when I interviewed him. And this is how he actually created some of the very first like viral content for The Hustle. They would go to a subreddit that was related to whatever the topic is that you're writing about, and then organize the posts in terms of popularity for all time, like all time popularity. And then what you do is you click on like the first five and read through the top comments on those posts. And so you're going to learn two things. You're going to learn like a topic that does really well inside of a certain audience.
Yeah.
And then
what gets people fired up.
Yep. And some of the comments are going to offer really good questions, right? And that's what we're really trying to build a list of here is like, what are the questions that people need answered? So that's another way. And then the last way I'll just give real quick is go back through your DMs. Like if you're interacting with people in this market, chances are they're already asking you questions that they probably need solved. In fact, if anyone's reaching out to you like out of the blue, I would wager that they're probably going to reach out with their most important question first. Do you get this, Tim? I'm sure people reach out to you like on Twitter and stuff. What's the most common question people reach out to you with? Does one come to mind?
What we're talking about right now. How do I get started? How do I get started? And that's why I think it's so important. I hate the answer, like, just get started. Like, it doesn't solve anything, right? And yeah, to an extent, you got to get some momentum. But in the way the internet is positioned right now, where everybody, every single day, I think like 3 or 4 episodes, when we talked about creator economy, we talked about this, where like more and more people are just starting to see, like, I need to get involved in this. And so if you don't have a good, if you don't know what you're aiming at from the very beginning, you're going to be running on a treadmill, basically. And so, yes, that's the most common Twitter DM I get is like, how do I get started? And my answer is always like, who you're talking to, the smaller, the better, because you can always grow. It's easier to grow over time. And even if you have an audience of 1,000 people, you know, if you find all 1,000 of those people, you can see what other kind of stuff they're interested in, and it can expand. So yeah, I love that. And another one that I would also add is Google Search Console. It's completely free. And it's all the Google data that you could ever want. It's different than maybe SEM Rush or Ahrefs, because it's a lot more about your particular website as opposed to just a free for all of data about search queries across the whole internet. But you can gather a lot of information about what's already working on your site and use that to make decisions about what will probably work in the future as well. So yeah, keywords everywhere, you said. Twitter, subreddits, or excuse me, Reddits, Reddit subreddits, Twitter DMs, and Google Search Console. Those are four mostly free tools. At the very most, you'll pay $2 or $3 a month, and you can get really far with just those four tools.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's really interesting to hear too that the most common question for you is like how to get started, and your most common advice relates to this, and specifically the topic of niching down, because that's my most common question. People, specifically the wording is how niche is too niche. So for newsletters, people reach out and everybody wants to know how niche is too niche. And similar to what you say, I really don't think there is such a thing as too niche anymore. I think that people like Sam would probably agree with this. A lot of the opportunity for like broad tech and business newsletters has been gobbled up by major players. Now, maybe that's a dumb thing to say, because like even Morning Brew, the size of their audience is peanuts compared to New York Times, right? Yeah. So maybe that's, you know, me just like not being open-minded enough about it.
Yeah, but the way I like to look at this is I like to increase the probability for success, because like nothing is ever guaranteed. And so like I try to frame these things in probabilities, and like the probability of winning going head to head with The Hustle is lower than, I mean, the best example that we've ever had of this, I think I mentioned this before, it totally affected me, was when we were going back and forth on Twitter about how niche is too niche. And this guy comes in, I was like, you can make a YouTube channel about mowing your lawn. And 10 minutes later, some guy must have saw the tweet and he posted a YouTube channel about mowing, not even grass, just his lawn. Like that was his whole entire brand, was mowing his lawn. And he built like a really cool, successful brand, and he had affiliate products that he was selling, and he was making ad revenue on YouTube, which, you know, that's not my favorite way to monetize, but he was still had some affiliates going and he was making money, right? Like, and he loves it. So yeah, like you could legitimately create a newsletter about mowing your own lawn and have 10,000, 50,000 subscribers. The dude had 60,000 subscribers. So like, I agree. You can't be too small. It's just not possible.
Yeah. And I think increasingly like that's where way more of the opportunity is, because you don't even need to be big. Like there's so many ways to monetize these days. I know somebody, maybe we talked about it here, they literally have sold more than $1 million worth of a course on how to paint water. Not how to paint, like not oil painting 101, but like, and everybody who paints knows that water is tough to paint, right? Well, they've done more than $1 million in sales of that course.
You didn't say that before.
Yeah, it's about that. Oh my god, it's nuts. And I think I mentioned last week, I have a friend who's got your list doesn't even have to be that big. So I've got a friend with a newsletter, about 1,000 subscribers, but it's incredibly niche, and the people on that list are willing to spend money, and so he sells affiliate products, and with less than 1,000 subscribers, or roughly 1,000 subscribers, is generating six figures a year. Amazing. So yeah, there's no such thing as too niche, but I do get where the hesitation comes from. I'm going through this now. I mean, that example of like, hey, I want to build an audience about notebooks. That's not entirely hypothetical. Notebooks are like a passion of mine, and I've thought about building something related to that just as a way, if nothing else, to like test different growth levers. But I mean, I haven't sat down to do it yet. And I think there's like a lot of the same hesitation is there, even when you know these things. Sure. It's hard to pull the trigger. So for everybody listening to this, if you haven't gone out and gotten started yet, don't beat yourself up too hard. Just go do it. So this tweet examines one growth lever, free growth lever, which is SEO. And I want to know first if you have anything else to say related to that, because it's a big topic. But I think there are other free growth methods that we could talk through as well, at least at a high level, just to kind of give people an idea for where this fits into the broader marketing framework, because SEO is really just one approach people could be using. So before we move on, we've got a couple of minutes left here. Is there anything else you would like? Actually, let me phrase it this way. What would you add to this tweet? If you had to add a sixth bullet to the way he's approaching this,
yeah,
what would you add?
Well, that is the perfect question, because I want to learn from you about other growth levers, because I'm just all in on SEO, not necessarily because I think that other things aren't good. It's just because I can't fit that much in my brain, you know? And so for me, it's like, find the one thing that works and double down on it. And as part of my own process, the sixth bullet point that I would put in here is he doesn't touch on automation. So the real, real diamond in the rough in this tweet, and there were, when I saw this tweet, there were two things that I was excited about expanding. One of them I already talked about, which is finding the pain points through psychographics. And the second one was using automation to truly, truly define your audience and sell them things. So when you give out free courses, I use Podia, by the way, P-O-D-I-A. It's very, very simple. If you combine Podia, Zapier, and ConvertKit, you can just create a one-man army of little, little tiny robots and automation and leverage that can like do wonders for you and your business. So my own course that I sell, Agency Clarity, if you go to agencyclarity.com, you don't even have to buy it. This isn't a plug, like just steal my idea, right? I created a free course on Podia. It's a 5-day course, basically about how I built a marketing agency. And then when you download that course, it goes through Zapier, and Zapier tags you in ConvertKit, which basically puts you on a pitch sequence and then sends you 5 or 6 different emails that tries to upsell you on the free course to buy the paid course. And then to really double down on that, this is a little bit more advanced, but still worth doing. If you go to deadlinefunnels.com, you can create a deadline that basically says like, okay, because you signed up for the free course, you're special more or less. Like obviously I spend a lot of time on the copy and on the automations, but it says you have 3 days to buy the upsell at a 30% discount. So just imagine this one concept and then expand it over 4 or 5 years worth of blog posts and 4 or 5 years worth of free content and 4 or 5 years worth of like different automations that you build. And if you just stay disciplined with this and you stay talking to your audience, you provide them free courses, you provide them with eBooks, the same things that worked 10 years ago work just as well today. But the difference is Zapier is probably the coolest tool on the internet. And when you combine Zapier with ConvertKit and come up with like really, really great automations and really great sales sequences, the sales part of it is automatic, because the copy is your salesperson and the automations is your sales team, and you don't need to hire anybody. And so once you get to that point, now you get to spend all of your time just growing your list. And so whether you do that through me with long form content on SEO, or you do that on Twitter, like, I don't know, maybe Trung would be a good example of that. Whatever your like growth mechanism is, now all of your attention is focused on just getting as many people to see your brand as possible, because the leverage is doing the hard work for you. So, you know, even talking about this, I get super animated because I'm so excited about it, because Zapier, like Podia, Zapier, and ConvertKit completely changed my life and, you know, like 50x'd my income. So if you can figure that part out, man, like you are, that's how you live that digital nomad lifestyle that we started this podcast talking about, where you want to get up and go to Miami for a month, right? Like go ahead, you can do it, because your sales team is still working just as hard as it was before you left.
For sure. Yeah. I'm so glad that you brought this up, because I think it actually brings some of the conversations we've had over the last few episodes full circle. When we started this, I did a little recap of what that high level framework was for content, entrepreneurship, if you will. Basically, you start with some kind of cash flow so that you're not worried about paying the bills. Then you build your list, that trust and influence, the list of people who not only knows you, but is willing to take action based on something you said. And then the last part is that products part. And what you just outlined is not just how to sell a paid product, which I think you nailed it. I mean, I recently shared a flow chart for like what the
sort of. I saw that. I was going to talk about that next week.
Oh yeah, we'll get into it. But but I think we don't even have to really, because you have basically summed it up here perfectly. When you look at the automations that are put in place to sell a paid product, strictly from like a structural perspective, they're designed to replace a salesperson. And so it's very simple. You need to capture somebody's information. You need to get in touch with them, and like you need to ask them to buy. And like, that's really what you're trying to do with a lot of these tools. It's not, it looks complex when you look at like how companies like, I don't know, New York Times or The Information or something actually structure these funnels, because they've had the time to continue tweaking and optimizing. Oh, yeah. But at a very basic level, that's what you're doing. You're replacing a salesperson with some automation. So I'm really glad that you brought that up. So what I like about SEO is that, as you mentioned, it's free and it's feasible if you have time and if you're able to figure out some words or keywords, topics that you actually stand a chance of competing in. Before we move on from this in particular, I wanted to add one more level to this, like SEO. So like, what would my sixth bullet be? Have you ever heard of the skyscraper tactic?
Okay. Yeah, totally. Speaking of SEMrush, skyscraper was Brian Dean from Backlinko. He basically invented this, and Backlinko just got bought by SEMrush last week.
Oh, really? Yeah. Yes, I had no idea, but this was new to me. So maybe it won't be new to people listening to this, but one last idea is like, if you do approach content in this way, I don't think you should leave things to chance. So the concept behind the skyscraper technique in its simplest form is you find content out there that already has a lot of people that are linking to it. You write something better, and then you reach out to everybody who's linked to it and you say, hey, like, do you want to link to this instead? So I just wanted to highlight that one additional piece of the equation, which is if you invest all this time and effort into like creating something great, there are things you can do that increase the odds that it's going to be found and valuable. So keep that in mind. At Trends, a couple of years ago, we started the research into this like extremely deep guide to building newsletter businesses. And we talked to people like all the way across the industry about everything from how do you grow to how do you monetize. And in the end, we were able to boil down growth to three levers. And here's what they are. So time, money, and audience. And the lever that you pull to grow your business is going to depend a lot on which of those three resources you have the most of at any given time. Sure. So when you're, and I'll give you quick examples from each of these. You know a lot of this. So I'm talking more to the audience.
No, but I got you. Like SEO would be time.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Any free tactic, you're basically leveraging time. Yeah. And so that's SEO. It's social media, like organic social media.
Yep.
Or like earned media. So PR, getting interviews on other places. These are all tactics that take a lot of time, but can have a big payoff, and they don't cost anything, right? Except for your time. Then money. Money is more obvious, like paid ads or influencer marketing. And then audience is like referral programs. And when your audience starts to get to the point where it's really able to continue growing your business in a meaningful way. And each one of these has its own little trick to it. And maybe this is a good place to leave off. So I'll give people the trick. And then if people want, they can let us know what they think, and we'll dig into it at a later episode. It can seem complex on the surface to say, well, if you want to grow for free, you have lots of options. You have social media, you have PR, you have blogging. But really, when you boil it down, this is what I think. I think what you're really trying to do is you're trying to get other people to tell your story. That's what you're doing. And I'll bet you've experienced this, Tim. Like either you or somebody you know has started a blog fully expecting the audience to just appear. Like if you build it, they will come, and the audience never came. Has that ever happened to you?
The worst marketing advice. Yeah. Just start writing. Just start putting it out there. Like, oh my goodness. What a great way to fall on your face.
Exactly. There's like a ton of time that goes into it. And everybody listen, I've done this. Everybody listening to this has been through this, and it's the most frustrating thing because you put a ton of time into it. So hopefully this helps. You're not just trying to put it out there. You are specifically, when you're using these free tactics, trying to get other people to talk about you. So what do I mean by that? SEO, you're getting search engines to talk about you. You're designing content in a way so that search engines say, oh, you're looking for this? You should check out so-and-so.
Yeah. Right?
Same thing with social media. Social media travels way further when other people are like retweeting or resharing. It doesn't matter how many likes you get on something, right? Like who's going to share it? That's what you're really trying to do. And I mean, PR, this is basic PR, right?
Yeah.
PR is other publications with an existing audience talking about you. So any American listening to this is probably familiar with the story of Paul Revere. Is it Paul Revere? Yeah. The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. Right?
Yeah.
Have you and I talked about this yet?
We talked about it when you were on my show.
Oh, a long time ago.
Yeah, before we were even doing this with Copyblogger.
Well, then I'll lay out the simple version here. And if people want to hear the full version, they should go check that out. Paul Revere was not the only person who rode to warn people about the British invasion. There were actually, I believe, four other riders that night. And one of them was a woman. They all took off. And some of them rode a lot further than Paul Revere did, too. Like this one guy, Israel Bissell, rode. Paul Revere rode like 12 miles. Israel Bissell rode for several days, hundreds of miles, like a very long ride. So why do we know his name? We know his name because Longfellow wrote the poem about the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. Somebody else told his story, and the other people's stories just never got told. It wasn't that he was the best.
Yeah.
It wasn't that, you know, like what he had done was measurably more impressive. It was that somebody else told his story. So if you're looking to grow, and you're going to use some of these free tactics, keep that in mind. The other buckets, paid and audience, they have their own tricks, but I'm going to leave it there. And I'll like, people can let us know if they want more on that.
Man, now I'm jacked up about this. How do you get people to tell your story? Like, isn't that marketing? You know, like, isn't that just like marketing? How do you get people to tell your story?
I think it is technically marketing, but here's the thing. Too often, I think people approach marketing with the intent of telling their own story, and they worry a lot about, well, what, you know, who are we and how do we describe ourselves?
Yeah.
If you want people to talk about you, you have to be interesting and like noteworthy, right? Everybody is. It's just whether or not you can convey that in a way that's effective. So this actually reminds me of something that Sam told me in another interview one time. They had done a really good job of growing the My First Million podcast. I forget what the numbers were, but like there's like a spike of growth when Sam kind of like took over that project as his full-time focus. And so I got him on an interview and I asked him like, what are the things that people get wrong with marketing? And he said, you know, one of them is a lack of showmanship. Nobody cares about showmanship anymore. Like if you think about P.T. Barnum and these guys back in the day, there used to be some flair to getting people's attention because you had to, right?
Yeah. Like
you couldn't force feed somebody an ad to your product inside their like Instagram feed. Showmanship's been lost as an art, but anybody who can figure it out and tap into that has a really powerful asset at their disposal because that like part of the human mind that's drawn to that has never changed.
Yeah, like the peacocking.
Yeah, it's never changed. And so if you're interested, he did give some like concrete advice on this. Like one of the best ways to figure out to really get a good feel for showmanship is to go back in time and read old ad copy.
Yeah.
Like Google's like book archive has old magazines.
Like Mad Men days.
Yeah. So here's an example. This is an old ad from like one of the first copies of Popular Aviation, which is now called Flying Magazine. It's been around for 95 years. A lot of the old issues are on like Google's archives, so you can just go read them for free. But you can see for anybody who's watching this, you can see the ad is like quite beautifully designed. It's not just it's not just simple text on a background. For anybody listening, it's basically designed as almost like, it almost looks like it's fanning out in the shape of a of an airplane prop. So at the top, the title's like large and it's arced like off of this big swoop, and then it funnels down towards the bottom, and at the bottom there's a picture of an airplane, and it's an ad for the Fairchild. It says Fairchild Perfection carried to the Great Northwest by the Mid-Plane Sales and Transit Co. And then the copies, you know, Fairchild Cabin Monoplane recognizes the world's finest all-purpose ships are distributed to the Great Northwest by this company. And it goes on to tell like just a little bit about like their sales and service and all the awards that they've won. And I think the thing to point out here is twofold. First, the ad like looks eye-catching. It's not just text on a blank background.
You're going to look at this.
Yeah. And the second is that they're not afraid to use wording that like gets people excited, you know, carried to the Great Northwest, like Fairchild Perfection. I don't know if that was a model or if they're just literally saying that they're
the world's finest all purpose ships.
Yeah. Or you read like old watch ads that talk about, you know, they'll talk about like quartz crystals, and all watches use quartz crystals and have for a long time, but they'll describe like the sweep of the second hand and like the perfect perfection. Or there's this very famous Rolls Royce ad that says like, you know, at 70 miles an hour, the loudest sound is the clock on the dashboard or something like that. Mm-hmm. That's showmanship. So these old ad writers, and they weren't all guys. We did a thing about this too. Like some of the most famous copywriters were women. They were constrained because it was incredibly expensive to sell via the mail. And so they had to figure out how to get somebody's attention and get them to act quickly. And so if you really want to study this, this is how Sam suggests you do it. Go back, read all those old ads. And actually, I don't know if I should plug this now, but Sam is, he's literally launching a course in February specifically about this. It's called, I don't know what it's called, but it's like, he's going to like send an
we'll
ad just like this.
Podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll yeah. So if you want to learn it from Sam, he's like one of the people in my opinion today, who's still really got a handle on this concept of like showmanship, and it's worth learning as a skill.
Love it. This is one of my favorite episodes again. I think we really laid out the 6-bullet-point process to get started. Next week, I do want to expand upon different mechanisms to grow. I want to provide other resources for people that maybe aren't into writing, you know, 2,000 word articles every week like I am. It's definitely not the only way to do it. And on that note, we got to have Nicholas Cole on the show once because of him and I and our Twitter beef. And I do think he brings a lot to the table about how to social blog, he calls it, in a way that will grow your list. But yeah, so let's talk about that next week. Man, anything else you got to say? This was so much fun.
No, I think this was awesome. I'm glad you sent this over. This was the topic. Everybody, if you enjoyed this, let us know. Be sure to like and subscribe. And you can find me over on Twitter at DamEthan. And Tim, what are you?
Tim Stodds.
Yeah. At Tim Stodds. Go check us out and get in touch.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. We will speak to you next Tuesday. Got any notes, hit us up on Twitter, and we'll talk to you next week. See ya.